RN, your world unfolding.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me on Big Ideas Tonight on RN and online at abc.net.au. Tonight, a call for major reform of the way we're governed. Ted Mack is the only person to have been elected and then re-elected as an independent to all three tiers of government in Australia. So he is uniquely well qualified to make such a call. Ted Mack wants an examination of the problems of our system of government and new electoral systems to reflect the will of the people. He's critical of the single-member electorate as the worst feature of our constitution and believes there's a need for an integrity level of government separate from the executive government and parliament. Such a role would be spelt out in the constitution as having no power in relation to political policy, but would ensure the integrity of government and the constitution is upheld. Illustrating that a more democratic constitution and governance is possible, he points to Switzerland. So here is Ted Mack with the 2013 Henry Parkes Oration delivered in Tenterfield, New South Wales, where Parkes gave his celebrated Federation speech on the 24th of October, 1889.
I came to politics some 40 years ago, having no previous involvement with political parties or organisations. In any case, over the next 20-odd years, I was given the unique experience of having an inside view of 14 years in local government, 7 in state government and 6 in federal government. Now, this didn't happen because the electors of North Sydney were carbon monoxide affected or because I had discovered some magic secret of electoral success. It happened because people saw the benefits of those three fundamental principles: open government, decentralised decision-making and financial probity, demonstrated in North Sydney Council for some 8 years. My comments today will cover the state of our political system, some of the causes of the problems, and to suggest possible directions for reform. Now, in 1992, the former Secretary of the Office of Governor-General, Sir David Smith, wrote, "There is much that is wrong with the way this nation is governed and administered. Never before have we had so many royal commissions and other inquiries. Never before have we had so many office holders and other figures in or facing the prospect of prison. Never before have the electors registered their dissatisfaction with the political process by returning so many independent and minor party candidates to Parliament." In the Mackay Report of July 2001, social researcher Hugh Mackay stated that, I quote, "Australia's contempt for federal politics and its leaders has plumbed new depths. If it was a family newspaper, we would scarcely be able to print the things Australians are saying about their politicians." Now, on 16th of June 2013, in the Australian newspaper, Tony Fitzgerald QC, who chaired the 1987 Queensland Royal Commission, wrote an article called "The Body Politic is Rotten." He stated there are about 800 politicians in Australia's parliaments. According to their assessments of each other, that quite small group includes role models for lying, cheating, deceiving, rorting, bullying, rumour-mongering, backstabbing, slander, leaking, dog-whistling, nepotism and corruption. He states in effect that the dominance of the major parties by, I quote, "little-known and unimpressive faction leaders who have had effective control of Australia's democracy and destiny might be tolerable if the major parties acted with integrity, but they do not. Over the last 30 years, there's been a plethora of minor and major scandals, misuse of most forms of parliamentary allowances, interstate travel, overseas travel, telephone allowances, comcars, taxis, air charters, stamp allowances, in addition to the revelations of major royal commissions. It seems that almost anything can and has been rorted. The number of resignations of ministers of state and federal parliaments shows that something is wrong with the selection process or the talent pool or both. One problem is that the ability to be a cabinet minister has got absolutely nothing to do with the ability to be a minister. In 1984, we had the Costigan Royal Commission revealing extensive criminal activities, tax fraud, and the notorious bottom of the harbour schemes. The cost was $13.9 million. 1987 saw the Fitzgerald Inquiry in Queensland initiated, leading to the Premier being deposed, three former ministers and the Police Commissioner going to jail, and the cost was $90 million. In 1991, we had West Australia Inc. revealing enormous corruption in politics and business in that state. Both Liberal and Labor premiers went to jail, and the cost was $30.5 million. In 1994, New South Wales had the Wood Royal Commission into the police. This resulted in the resignations and dismissal of the police commissioner and some 92 officers. Cost was $70 million. Yet after all this, the public has watched in disgust at the collapse of the New South Wales Iema, Rees, Keneally governments in 2007-11, exposing the worst level of government corruption in Australian history. The 1910-13 federal parliament saw the major parties virtually eliminate any form of democratic debate, substituting little but character assassination of opponents. It was a three-year election campaign of personal abuse and fear-mongering. It was debased even further with aggressive bullying by the media and special interest at unprecedented levels. The same period saw both state and federal governments pandering to special interests, allowing massive increases in the promotion of gambling and alcohol, pandering to the development and mining industries and the seemingly endless privatisation of public assets, creating often private monopolies, continued irrespective of public opinion. The last decade has also seen a substantial escalation in the endless Commonwealth state turf wars. This seems to bedevil almost all main areas of government activities, such as health, education, transport, agriculture, and water policy. This massive overlap of functions results in huge increases in bureaucracy. The expansion of government, particularly the cost of expanding staff and salaries, seems to be in inverse proportion to the levels of public satisfaction. Recent increases bring the basic salary of the Prime Minister to $507,000, compared to the American President at $400,000, and the English Prime Minister at only £142,000. Salary packages for MPs have escalated at federal level with a steady creation of new positions and extensions of fringe benefits, so much so that only a handful of backbench members of the government receive the lowest salary package, which is the one you ever hear about. State governments have followed suit. The salary package, as opposed to the basic salary, for federal government members now range from about $325,000 to some $475,000 per annum for ministers. However, extremely generous superannuation schemes can effectively double that, depending on age at retirement. For example, recently retired after 9 years in the New South Wales Upper House, Eric Rusendale, aged 51, received a pension of $125,000. This is indexed to future politicians' salaries, not to the gold standard or the share market or future inflation. It's to future politicians' salaries, and as long as the Commonwealth of Australia and the state of New South Wales exist, it'll be paid. Given his life expectancy, this works out at about $500,000 a year for his 9 years of office. Together with his annual salary, he was rewarded with almost $1 million for each year in Parliament. Now, this is a job that the officials of political parties can bestow on people with virtually no experience or qualifications. 10 ex-prime ministers and governors general each average around $500,000 a year in public costs, or around $10,000 a week in retirement. But the annual appropriation available for the current governor general's office is approaching $13 million per annum. Over the last 30 years, politician staff has increased dramatically. At federal level, there are now some 1,700 personal staff for ministers and members, 1,700. The states account for about 2,000 more. Add to this the direct political infiltration of the federal state public services and quangos, with hundreds more jobs for the boys and girls, there is now a well-established political class. This has provided the political parties with a career path for members. In many cases, it often produces skilled, partisan, quote, whatever it takes warriors, with a richly rewarded life through local, state and federal governments to a well-funded retirement. Unfortunately, while this career path, as Tony Fitzgerald states, does include principled, well-motivated people, it also attracts professional politicians with little or no general life experience and unscrupulous opportunists unburdened by ethics who obsessively pursue power, money or both. Since the 1990s, there's been endless calls by federal and state governments for increased efficiency, no wage increases unless matched with productivity for restructuring, downsizing and deregulation, all in the name of competitiveness and facing the international community in the 21st century. Many thousands of jobs have disappeared, particularly those in federal and state bureaucracies at middle and lower incomes and in the general workforce. Now, there's little doubt that some restructuring of the country is necessary, but it's strange that the political administrative structure and the legal system are somehow excluded from any need for reform, particularly given both the massive costs and level of public dissatisfaction. It's surprising that while the media regularly exposes major and minor political misdemeanours, it rarely proposes any serious need for reform, let alone suggests possible solutions. Our many publicly funded schools of government and politics also seem to be largely silent on the need for political or constitutional reform, with some honourable exceptions. In an effort to increase public confidence in the political system, a huge amount of legislation has been passed in recent years to ostensibly promote such things as open government, public participation, and reduced reliance on private donations. Effectively, the open government legislation has mainly meant freedom from information. Even this year, the Labor government and the then opposition quietly combined to sneak through legislation that completely exempted the three government departments that supervise the running of federal parliament from answering freedom of information requests. As for public participation, virtually all government decisions are made in private by small groups of people who in many cases are not in parliament. Public funding of elections was first introduced into New South Wales in 1961 and federally in 1984 on the basis that it would reduce private donations. Neville Rand presented the bill and concluded his speech by saying that this bill, and I quote, will remove the risk of parties selling political favours and declares to the world that the great political parties of New South Wales are not up for sale. I don't know what he'd say about Eddie O'Brien. Since then, escalating arms war of election spending has developed, with public funding steadily increasing and private funding increasing even faster. The taxpayer cost of federal elections has increased from $38 million in 1984 to $161 million in 2010. Of the latter, $53 million was public funding to parties and candidates. Currently, in spite of massive increases, public funding is less than 20% of about $350 million of total election spending. We are now effectively the second best democracy money can buy. There is an overwhelming need to reduce election spending. In the United States, democracy has largely been destroyed by the huge amount of money dedicated to this purpose, and Australia's accelerating down the same tollway. Maximum spending limits must be applied to all elections. At present, freedom of speech is only effectively available to the rich and those using other people's money. The Electoral Commission should produce booklets setting out candidates' biographies and policies, as was done for the 1999 Constitutional Convention elections, with all advertising banned. Organisations have been set up to monitor government's administration. We've had ombudsmen of various varieties, royal commissions, anti-corruption bodies, competition commissions, auditors, the Remuneration Tribunal, the Electoral Commission, the Competition Commission, ASIC and many others. To some extent, these so-called independent bodies have not been as successful as originally hoped for and only operate at fearful cost. Codes of ethics are a favourite device, as are claims of independent speakers often made by incoming governments to address behaviour of members. Wait till they see Bronwyn in action. History shows that ethics and fair speakers never last. The code is soon buried and fair speakers are sacked. Political parties, as they have developed over the last century, seem like two mafia families seeking control of the public purse for distribution to themselves, supporters, special interests who fund them, and buying votes at the next election. Political parties are not mentioned in the Constitution. They are effectively unregulated private organisations, but they now control government treasuries. When they unite with common interests, for example, funding themselves, the public are mostly powerless, except on rare occasions when the public outrage is too great. For example, the attempted $60 million virtually secret increase in public funding for parties earlier this year. Both parties have rightly suffered huge reductions in membership over the last few years, almost in direct proportion to the centralisation of power in their organisations. Public funding and huge allowances have reduced the party's need for workers for elections. Candidates can now rely on direct mail, general advertising and paid help. By centralising power, as Tony Fitzgerald put it, the public interest is subordinated to the pursuit of power, party objectives and personal ambitions, sometimes including the corrupt acquisition of financial benefit. Branch stacking has become endemic and again, as Fitzgerald says, the parties gift electorates to family connections, malleable party hacks and mediocre apparatchiks. The views of people like retired Judge Tony Fitzgerald QC, Hugh Mackay, possibly Australia's leading social researcher, and Sir David Smith, official secretary to five Governor-Generals, should be taken seriously. They have had long experience of government in Australia and their views are well-founded. They demand examination of the many problems of our systems of government in order to establish directions for reform. The Australian Constitution could only be based on conditions existing in the late 19th century. As Professor Helen Irving states in her recent book, Five Things to Know About the Australian Constitution, she says, it does not mean what it says. It does not say what it means. It says some things without actually saying them. It fails to say some things that might be important, and it does say some things that might be important. Today it's not only obsolete, but it's an expensive handicap to the well-being of Australian society. In essence, it was a parochial compromise between the states based on an amalgamation of the British and American constitutions. We followed English parliamentary practice, but without accepting English traditional restraints. For example, in Westminster, the speaking is genuinely fair. Speaker is genuinely fair. In Australia, fair speakers are quickly dispensed with and the government must always win. This is why question time in Australia always descends to a schoolboy rabble. We have a system where the opposition almost always loses and has virtually no role in legislation. This forces members to extremes to magnify differences, often reaching levels of mindless partisanship only seen at football matches. The two-party system of government and opposition, where the winner takes all, has inevitably resulted in mutual denigration with little or no sensible parliamentary debate. Frankly, in Australian parliaments, opposition is a form of political death. The thought of it colours all decision-making. It entrenches the philosophy of whatever it takes. It even means less salaries for members of the opposition, shock horror. The election of governments by parliamentary members in the absence of fixed terms means a rigid parliamentary discipline must be enforced in order to achieve political stability. Extreme partisanship takes over and the public interest is irrelevant. Parliament can never be a check on executive government except in rare situations. Domination of parliament by executive government effectively means it's an elected dictatorship, except in the rare cases of hung parliaments, which have their own problems. The two-party system stifles ideas, debate and decision-making within the parties. The faction system often ensures minority views triumph within both party rooms. In the case of the government, the minority view will then be taken into parliament and become a minority law. Hence the shocking derailing of democratic government in New South Wales in 2007 to 11. Voting within parties is often based on what faction the members belong to, who wants to become or stay a minister, and who wants to become or stay party leader. What the electors think is at best a secondary consideration. Party members almost always follow the party line and are often voting against what they really believe in or what their electorates would want. A classic example of this was the 1999 Republic referendum, where opinion polls showed that over 70% of people wanted the right to vote for any future president, but only 3 out of 225 members of federal parliament supported that position. A few years of regularly voting and speaking against what they believe in, I suspect many seem to cease to believe in anything and take refuge in the extreme partisanship following whatever is the official party executive's position. After 112 years, the functions of Commonwealth and state governments, as well as the financial arrangements, are in chaos. This has resulted in endless dispute, waste and inefficiency between state and federal governments and their bureaucracies. A century of debate and confusion over these issues shows that the problems are impossible to resolve without a rewrite of the Constitution. Our founding fathers at the conventions of the 1890s must have been blinded by the magnificence of the British Empire at the zenith of its power to adopt the worst feature of the Constitution, and that is the single-member electorate system. Electing parliaments by voting for single members, then having elected members elect a government, is a democratic travesty kept alive by politicians, academia and the press. There was little excuse for the founding fathers, let alone today's political establishment. John Stuart Mill, known as the most influential English-speaking philosopher of the 19th century, set out the principles of democratic voting in 1861. He clearly showed that single-member electorate system results in only accidental relationship between seats won and the total actual votes. This occurs because it's possible to win 100% of the seats with around 43% of the vote. For example, the 2012 election in Queensland produced the bizarre result that the state government won 88% of the seats with 49.7% of the vote. 88% of the seats with 49.7% of the votes, not even a majority. The other 50.3% of voters were rewarded with 12% of the seats. The single-member electorate system also largely eliminates minorities unless their vote is concentrated in particular electorates. This is why such parties as the Australian Democrats and Greens get almost no lower house seats. Now, you might like that, but it's not democracy. Often with twice the vote of the National Party, while the latter generally receives around 10 members and 3 or 4 ministers and deputy prime minister. It's fundamental to liberal democracy that while a majority should rule, minorities should be represented according to their proportion of their support. It's even more essential that the electoral system should represent the will of the people. The single-member electorate system does neither, and in addition results in a maximum, not a minimum, wastage of votes. Since the Second World War, federal elections have resulted in 5 governments elected with a minority of the two-party preferred votes, a minority of the two-party preferred votes. Yet the fundamental rule of democracy is majority rule. Conversely, only 3 governments out of 26 achieved 50% of the primary vote, and surprisingly, as did one opposition, and they ended up in opposition with 50% of the primary vote. No wonder most governments are unpopular soon after the euphoria of an election fades. So why do we keep the single-member electorate system? Well, the answer is because only the major parties can change it. But why should they? Because it helps preserve the two-party duopoly. It largely prevents the election of third-party candidates. An incumbent lower house federal candidate today has effectively about $400,000 worth of facilities and money to ward off challengers. I don't think I could get elected today, frankly, in this situation. Major parties can transfer $1 million or so extra dollars from safe seats if they want to really stop an outsider. It also enables the government parties to pork barrel specific seats. In proportional voting, you can't do that, but in our system, you can. It's hardly an equal opportunity for challengers, whether they're individuals or new parties. There have been many changes to electoral systems over the last century, but almost all have been made for partisan reasons. Now, the Senate, of course, is fundamentally flawed as a democratic organisation in any case. In each election, 42.3% of the vote will elect 50% of the senators in each state for a start. Then there's the voting system, which allows parties to transfer preferences without the voters' knowledge. This system led to the infamous 1999 tablecloth election in New South Wales, with dozens of new political parties created to take advantage of this undemocratic system. In that election, a candidate was elected to the New South Wales Upper House with a primary vote of 0.2%, receiving preferences from mostly unknown parties. This is known as harvesting of preferences and has certainly distorted elections. Even the New South Wales government, which some would say was the epitome of all political evil, reformed this system 14 years ago by ensuring that only the voter could transfer preferences. Yet similar distortions have been obvious at federal level in 2004 and 2010. And yet here we are in 2013 with the same rot. We now have some five senators elected with no democratic legitimacy, all because the major parties are so venal and prepared to treat voters as mushrooms to obtain power. It is to Australia's shame that at least 99% of voters, that's all of us just about, at the recent elections had no idea where our Senate vote really went. Certainly, electoral reforms for the Senate, for the wrong reasons in 1949, providing for proportional representation, does make the Senate more reflective of the Australian voter than the lower house. However, the unequal state and arbitrary territory representation is fundamentally undemocratic. It cannot be democratically acceptable to have, for example, one Hobart vote equal 14 Tenterville votes, or one Darwin vote worth almost three Bendigo votes when voting for issues that affect all Australians equally. Australia's electoral systems at federal and state level, excluding the ACT and Tasmania, are, in my view, clearly in breach of Article 25 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Australia is a signatory and has ratified. They do not, and I quote, guarantee the free expression of the will of the electors, and federal elections are not, quote, by equal suffrage, and candidates are not freely chosen. As things stand, Australian democracy consists of voting for a rigged system every few years to elect others to make decisions for us. The voters mostly know little or nothing about candidates after the faceless men and brand stackers have had their way. We're rarely permitted to have any say on policies. Cabinet ministers, premiers and prime ministers come and go without any reference to us. We go to war and sign treaties without even our parliament having a say, let alone the public. When the major parties agree, as they do when funding themselves and their mutual friends, we have no say whatsoever. It's a pretty minimalist democracy and a long way from Abraham Lincoln's government of the people, by the people, for the people. We seem to have achieved government of the people, by the power brokers, for the mates. Most people today believe they have a right to have a say in all decisions that affect them. Yet the usual position of politicians is to say, we were elected to make the decisions, and if you don't like it, you can vote against us at the next election. This view is totally unsatisfactory. It is a decision that people are interested in, not revenge some years later. In addition, general elections provide only a mandate to govern. They do not provide a mandate for all or any future decisions, except in rare circumstances. There are only about 30 or so countries you could call partial democracies, but only Switzerland that fulfills Lincoln's definition of democracy. Now, this is not surprising, considering democracy, while enjoying a brief starburst in Greece about 2,500 years ago, democracy really only took form in the modern form in the 18th century after the French and American revolutions. Unfortunately, writing constitutions has inherent problems. They can only reflect the values of their time. They're doomed to obsolescence and are usually difficult to change. Bills of Rights have the same problems in addition to politicising the judiciary and weakening democracy. Constitutional problems have been obvious for many years and there have been many attempts at reform, but with little result. One of the virtues of the Australian Constitution is that the Founding Fathers gave the right to vote to change it exclusive to the public by way of referendum. Unfortunately, they gave the right to ask the question for public consideration exclusively to the government. The government, however, has only asked to be given more power. Many party-oriented people decry the ignorance of the voter for the high failure vote of referenda, but the real lesson of a century of mostly failed constitutional referenda is that generally any suggestion of centralised power will be rejected. This view is reinforced by the fact that 12 out of 16 referenda in New South Wales have been carried, as they are about specific issues rather than centralisation of power to the government. The fundamental problems of our system of government have not seriously ever been addressed since Federation. These problems can be summarised as the level of over-government, the obsolescence of the constitutional relationships between the three levels, the two-party winner-take-all executive domination of Parliament, and the associated corrupted voting systems. The domination of the political system and the public service by two private unregulated parties and their largely self-regulated access to the public treasury, and almost a total absence in the school system and for new citizens of any education concerning the three levels of government, their functions and voting systems.
You're listening to Big Ideas on RN. If you'd like to join the online discussion on tonight's topic, jump onto our website at abc.net.au/Radio National. In his speech, former independent MP Ted Mack acknowledges serious reform is perhaps many years down the track, but democracy is making reasonable progress, he says. Here, he suggests possible directions for such reform.
In recent years, there's been calls for the abolition of the states in response to the frustration of Commonwealth-state relations. Now, this is understandable, but in my view, misguided. As with other large countries such as the United States, Russia, India, Germany, all are federal, being too large to have acceptable unitary democratic arrangements. In such countries, and there are others for particular reasons, there's national, regional and local issues and all should be represented. Australia's problem is that there's no clarity in our constitution on what each level should do. Ideally, each level should spend and raise its own finance. Deciding what functions each level should do is vital, as it appears that historically the tendency is to centralise. Both Australia and USA are suffering from bloated federal bureaucracies. Functions, it seems, in my view, are best performed at the lowest practical level. And here again, Switzerland shows the way. In Australia, the states are the level of government most overrepresented with their 598 members of Parliament. Their Westminster systems are wasteful, inefficient, and should be replaced with single chamber parliaments with generally increased numbers of voters with a minimum, say, of 15 members. States like Queensland, West Australia, or Tasmania is the worst. Every second person's a politician, practically. The level of representation is so high. And they get much the same money as a federal member. So if a federal member these days is representing around 100,000 people, I think the states should, well, maybe that's still a bit high for the states, but they should at least be up in the 75,000 class. But I say Queensland, West Australia, I think are down in sort of 10,000, 15,000 people per member of parliament. There's also a good case, in my view, for creating more states and regions than the draftsmen of the British Foreign Office decided in the middle of the 19th century. One of the reasons decentralisation has never really worked in Australia is that all power resides in the six capital cities. The New South Wales boundaries with all three adjoining states are now quite inappropriate and could well be broken into six or seven states. Queensland and Victoria lend themselves to about four states each. Logically, Northern Territory and Kimberley should be one state. As to the basic structure of Parliament, there are only two broad systems that are in use that are generally regarded as democracies. The first is developed in England substantially in the 18th century is the one we now have, parliaments using single-member electorates. The second is those elected by proportional representation developed in the 19th century with usually 5 to 10 political parties. This not only allows more representative views to be aired, it also has more eyes watching the system, tending to reduce corruption. Arend Lippert, a world-renowned political science, in his book Patterns of Democracy, analysing governments and their performance in 36 countries, concludes that consensual political systems using proportional representation stimulate economic growth, control inflation, unemployment, and limit budget deficits, as well as countries using single-member electorate systems. However, he also concludes that the consensual democracies clearly outperform single-member electorate systems on measures of political equality, women's representations, citizens' participation, and proximity between government policies and voter preferences, which is, after all, what democracy is really all about. He also demonstrates that the more consensual a democracy, the kinder and gentler it is when addressing such issues as welfare, environment, criminal justice and foreign aid. The single-member electorate system is largely confined to the English-speaking world, but overwhelmingly most democracies use proportional representation. Our system, as indicated earlier, has major defects, and it is promoted by claiming that it's necessary for the stability of government. But it relies on manufacturing a false majority and preserving the two-party system. It's no accident that both the American and British systems are currently experiencing major problems stemming from their single-member electorates. There are far better ways of preserving stability of government without compromising the electoral system. There is the American method of separately electing executive government, or if you really want stability, consider Switzerland. Its seven-member executive federal government has never been renewed entirely at the same time over 175 years. It is elected by the Parliament every 4 years, and only four members have been voting out in over 150 years. Most members retire after two or three terms. Since 1990, Switzerland has had some 22 ministers in federal government. In the same time, we've had a kaleidoscope of over 300 ministers. If that's not enough to scare our political parties, there's an amazing fact that there are only seven full-time paid federal politicians in the Swiss executive and lower house for their 8.5 million people, compared to our 150. The two-party system is essentially preserved by the single-member electorate system. In proportional representation countries, there is an average of about 5 to 10 parties, an increase in political ideas, and a more democratic reflection of the voters. There are a number of variations of proportional representation methods are used around the world, but surprisingly, the most democratic yet devised is the Hare-Clark system used in Tasmania and in a form in the Australian Capital Territory. This was largely initiated by Andrew Inglis Clark in around 1900 as the Attorney General in the Tasmanian Parliament. He also penned the first draft of the Australian Constitution, but unfortunately didn't attend any of the conferences because of ill health. This voting system accurately reflects the will of the people. To obtain 50% of the seats, you must receive 50% of the vote. But it gives the electors the choice of party candidates. Voters can replace unsatisfactory members with another candidate from the same party. Wastage of votes is minimal, as is the practice of branch stacking. Minorities are represented according to their size. Donkey votes, how-to-vote cards and by-elections are all eliminated. Ideally, it uses 7 or 9-member electorates, similar to the Senate 6-member electorates, and all preferences should be optional. It also uses much larger electorates that, if combined with electronic voting in Parliament to adjust for population shifts, electorate boundaries could be drawn that really reflect community of interest and rarely need to change. This would eliminate the current horrendous cost of constantly adjusting federal and state electoral boundaries and the confusion that's created. Possibly the greatest problem with governments around the world is self-regulation. History demonstrates that when politicians have free access to treasuries, the results are always, to put it, unsatisfactory. The present Australian system of effective self-regulation for wages and fringe benefits for politicians, unlike the great majority of other employers, is totally unacceptable. This self-regulation produces a mutual waltz where the politicians tell the public servants you're worth more money and the public servants return the favour. This flows through to all political and public service positions in the Commonwealth and states, the respective judiciaries and the quangos. The politicians hide behind a carefully selected remunerations tribunal consisting of 3 persons drawn from the highest paid people in Australia. 2 are retired CEOs of BHP and the other ones, I think, a retired CEO of one of the major banks. These people think $1 million a year is just peanuts. You know. A common problem is the confusion of the roles of representatives and government. Representatives' role is to represent the people. This does not require high management skills or technical skills, and they are unrepresentative if they are, as at present, among the top 1% of wage earners. Government ministers, however, require largely a different and much greater set of skills. The failure rate of federal and state ministers is such that it is obviously being drawn from too small a pool. Ministers would be better if they could be drawn from the whole community, either appointed as in America or elected as in Switzerland. According to the Sydney Morning Herald of January the 10th, 2011, the best paid civil servant in New South Wales was the head of Energy Australia at $774,799 plus perks. The Australian newspaper in September 2011 reported a number of federal public service heads were expected to rise from the current $500,000 per annum to $800,000 per annum, plus perks, or around $56,000 a week. All this follows the pattern of private CEOs. Recently, Melbourne University economist Mike Pottinger reported that in 1900, the BHP chief executive salary was around 50 times the average weekly wage of Australians. By the 1980s, this ratio had dropped to only 6 or 7 times as much. The ratio then rapidly increased to 200,000 times by 1998, touching 250 times by 2005. It's fallen back these days to about 160 times to only 12.58 million per annum plus perks. Of course, the CEOs and company directors effectively set their own salaries. Frankly, there's no evidence that executives, both public and private, are so superior to their counterparts prior to the 1980s that could justify such massive salary increases. As things stand, politics is now the province of a political class that offers a lifetime career in federal and state parliaments, the public service and quangos. Entrance to this world often involves nepotism and cronyism. There can be few other legitimate jobs with salary packages over $300,000 that can be obtained with virtually no experience and qualifications and little restrictions on second jobs or holidays. Equating integrity with paying more money flies in the face of history. By paying politicians salary packages of over $300,000, more people are attracted who couldn't get that salary anywhere else. In fact, people pursuing material gain should be discouraged from entering politics. There's certainly no evidence that the massive increases of salary packages in recent years has increased benefits to the public or improved the quality of members or ministers compared to governments of the past. Far from paying peanuts and getting monkeys, paying more peanuts seems to attract gorillas. Avenues for ambition, financial advancement, offers of prestigious government appointments, indeed all possible inducements that could colour a member's voting should be eliminated where possible. Limitation of office of, say, 3 terms should apply with only inflation-indexed salaries. Using any political or government office for personal financial gain over and above the official salary should result in dismissal. Attempting to influence a member's voting with financial or any other form of fringe benefits should be a criminal offence. The politicisation of Australia's public services over the last 30 years has degraded many public organisations and reduced government's ability to implement policy even when they're acting in the public interest. The notorious self-regulation politician superannuation scheme should be abolished. They should obtain superannuation in the same manner as the rest of the community. The problem of self-regulation was well put by the former clerk of the Senate, Harry Evans. He pointed out that the present system was like a cricket match where the captain of the batting side was also the umpire. When ministers or members of the batting side played false shots, they're rarely and reluctantly given out. There really needs to be an independent umpire to not only monitor ministers and members, but to appoint the Speaker of Parliament from outside Parliament. A fully independent public service board needs to be reinstated for all government appointments, particularly for such bodies as the Ombudsman, Corruption Commissions, Auditor General, Police Integrity Commission, the Electoral Commission and Remuneration Tribunal. Appointments must be based on only proven competence and integrity. The main reason that many of these bodies at present falls short of public expectations is that the executives are appointed by the government and their briefs are constrained by the government, yet their role will often involve the investigation of government bodies. In other words, all those bodies that have no political functions but are there to ensure the integrity of the system should be independent of government. One feature of our original federal constitution that should be reinstated is the role for a directly elected Governor-General to fully umpire the system in addition to the traditional role as head of state. He or she could also head a fourth arm of government known as the Integrity Branch. Such a role for the Governor-General would be spelt out in the Constitution as having no political power except to ensure the integrity of government and to ensure the Constitution is upheld. The concept of a separate fourth branch of government has been canvassed in legal circles in recent years, particularly by James Spiegelman in 2004, the then Chief Justice of New South Wales Supreme Court. It's been extensively examined in the October 2012 issue of the Australian Institute of Administrative Law Forum, magazine number 70. As James Spiegelman pointed out in his two lectures, the concept of a separate integrity level of government is surprisingly an ancient Chinese concept. In the last three decades, we have informally created this fourth branch as a means of stemming various problems, but with only limited success. Formalising its independence from government would certainly improve its performance. Now, earlier I've made reference to various aspects of the Swiss government from which we could learn. The fundamental advantage over all other democratic systems in Switzerland is the use of what's called direct democracy. In Switzerland, the people are sovereign. They can overrule the government, the parliament, and even the constitutions at will. Referenda on the constitution or policy can and are initiated by the people every 3 months. Government legislation can be cancelled or amended by the people. From 2000 to 2012, there have been some 104 referenda at federal level. This is an average of 8 per year, and there are many more at state and council levels. They have dealt with all sorts of issues that dominate our parliaments in angry, abusive debates. The Swiss government seems to quietly get on with implementing public policy as set by the public. This means that all government deliberations are mostly on a consensual basis. If it isn't, it generally means a referendum, and there's no formal opposition in Switzerland. Think of that. At federal level, there is the seven-member parliament, a government elected proportionally by the parliament with candidates drawn from the whole community. The effect of this is calm deliberation, none of our daily chaos and accusations. The seven members of government take it in turn annually to be prime minister with no additional power or money. Apparently most people are unsure in Switzerland who the prime minister is. There's no career path. They're not on the front pages of the paper every day, whether they're fighting fires or going in bike races. There's no career path for federal members of parliament who are all part-time. No leadership fights, no minority governments, no dramatic changes of governments, public policies or public servants after elections. Fundamentally, the Swiss government cannot enact any law without majority support. You can begin to see why the Swiss system has been kept a secret for the last century. It's informative that whereas many decry the difficulty of amending our constitution because of the requirement for a referendum, the Swiss, however, have no trouble and have amended it constantly since 1848. The difference is the people ask the questions, not the politicians. It is government by the people. It's very easy to sneer at the Swiss system, as most elitists do. It's often been done with humour, as in the movie The Third Man, when Orson Welles said, and I quote, "In Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci and the Renaissance. In Switzerland they had brotherly love, 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock." But that was only a movie. He didn't say that it was the leading democracy in the world, arguably the most successful multicultural society and amongst the highest per capita income and life expectancy. They haven't had a war since the French Revolution invaded them in about 1800. It's a land almost without tennis courts or a nation, yet they produced Roger Federer and won the America's Cup. And while still not perfect, their first university was founded in 1460, and I think we can still learn from them. No serious observer in politics in Australia, except those with specific interests, can pretend we do not have major problems with our system of government or that we're incapable of achieving any improvement after a century of experience. Minimalism in our approach to a new constitution would always be a mistake, as outstanding constitutional experts have documented, such as Helen Irving in her 2001 Barton Lecture, David Solomon in his book Coming of Age, A Charter for New Australia, and Harry Evans, the former Clerk of the Senate, arguably Australia's leading expert on constitutions and government. There have been many new constitutions written since the Second World War. Most have been prepared in times of overwhelming crisis or the urgent aftermath of revolution or war. Fortunately, we don't have this degree of urgency. In an analysis of the survey of constitution making in the book Democracy's Victory and Crisis by John Elster, former of the Universities of Chicago, Oslo and now Columbia University, has distilled some basic principles. First, a democratic constitution is best formulated through a fully elected constitutional commission. Parliament should not be allowed to be judges in their own case. Serving politicians and bureaucrats will almost never have the public interest at heart when ceding or gaining turf, as evidenced by the last century of attempts at reform. Second, the role of experts and lawyers should be advisory rather than in actual decision-making. Third, constitutions should be evolved in calm, generally open, deliberate and measured conditions, avoiding what is called grandstanding and rhetorical overbidding. Secrecy should be minimised to avoid partisan interests and log rolling coming to the forefront and threat-based bargaining. Fourth, any constitution should not come into effect until sometime after it has been adopted, so as to reduce the impact of short-term partisan motives. Following these principles, a fully elected constitutional commission should be convened on the basis of a one vote, one value on an Australia-wide proportional basis. It should be serviced by a technical secretariat and meet for short sessions over a substantial period of time. It should have the power to utilise polling and to put plebiscites to the people, ideally to coincide with elections to establish fundamental directions. Eventually, the Commission should be authorised to institute a referendum on the basis that the new constitution will not come into effect for, say, 7 years. Serious reform is, of course, many years into the future, and the obstacles and enemies of democratic reform are many. The political parties and their partisan supporters' overwhelming interest is gaining power and preserving the political duopoly. Big business is implacably opposed to more democracy. It wants more centralisation of power. It currently employs more than 600 registered lobbyists in Canberra and spends millions of dollars to subvert democracy. Big media is always constrained by its owner's interests. And since the Second World War, there's been a growth of corporate propaganda to protect corporate power against democracy. Nevertheless, given authoritarian government has been the norm for most of the modern humans' 200,000-year history, and democracy seriously arrived just over 200 years ago, it's making reasonable progress, but there is still a long way to go. Thank you very much.
Former Independent MP Ted Mack delivering the 2013 Henry Parkes oration from Tenterfield, New South Wales. These orations promote public understanding of Australia's constitutional structures and political systems. Thanks to the Big Ideas production team this week, Karen Zvanovitz, Ian Coombe, David LeMay, Peter McMurray and Jim Usher. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.